Welcome to the Prakriti podcast, Clinical Education in One Coffee. My name's Matt Cooper and I'm joined today by Craig Taylor. Morning, Craig.
Morning, Matthew.
Thank you, Craig. Gee, you sound like my grandmother.
We're very formal today.
Oh, exactly right. Now, today we want to talk about subcontractors versus employee. And this is really common for physios and osteos and chiros who move out from university into private practice. So we want to give you some general guidelines and some things you should look out for and even ask in the interview process. So you've got a greater understanding of what your rights are and what it's going to look like for you moving into private practice.
I'd like to just point out that this is a discussion between the two of us. Mm. It's definitely not we think one way is better than another. And also from a legal point of view, we're definitely not giving advice which is hard and fast. We really want just to have a conversation about things to think about and how you can approach those situations.
Yeah, very good point, Craig. And look, this is just general advice and from our experiences. And we both of us have worked as subcontractors mainly. Now both clinical directors who Craig has subcontractors working under him. I actually have a little bit of both employees and subcontractors. So we've got that experience there to hopefully give some general advice and give you a bit of an understanding on what that means. Now just so you know, pretty much, and I'll draw from my own experience, I moved into a private practice as a subcontractor straight out of uni, and what that meant was I paid a percentage of the takings back to the clinic as rent. Now, that rent was, I can't remember the exact percentage, but let's just say for argument's sake, it was 50-50, yeah? And so what that meant is that I would pay 50% plus GST. Now, remember the GST component, because people often get confused about that, back to the clinic. So if it was a $100 consult fee, 50% would stay with me and then 50% would go to the clinic. But plus that GST component actually meant that 55 would go back to the clinic and 45 would come to me. Yeah. Now, part of that $45 is, you've got to factor in your leave and your super and your tax and all those sorts of things. And that's how a subcontractor model should work. And strictly speaking, as a subcontractor, you should be, paying for a lot of your own sort of things as well. Now, a lot of clinics don't do that, and certainly the clinics that I were in didn't do that, but little things like reception and business cards and, even
towels,
linen, soap, all these sorts of things, needles, tape, whatever else, might come into that, and whereas the clinics I worked in certainly didn't have that.
I think that it's just important in those situations that there's an understanding, ideally in writing, what the clinic provides for your fee. Are they shared consumables, or are you expected to deliver all of your own components? And my experience is very much similar to yours, Matthew, where I've paid that that amount to the clinic, that's been all inclusive of all the services they provide. I think that's probably the most common situation.
Yeah. And I think you'll find over, when I first started, I worked in two separate clinics and my percentages were different in both, yet, and there's not really a consistent percentage across the board. It's very much what the directors are comfortable to pay. And realistically, from that point, I think you should keep an eye out on what they're charging around that. Like the clinic that I had a higher percentage in, I actually earned less than the clinic I had a lower percentage because their consultation fees were quite different. And so it's good to get an understanding about that. And, 60% might sound fantastic, but there mightn't be much wiggle room there for future growth. And if you're really then relying on them increasing their consultation fees to gain a pay rise, Whereas, you know, you might be at 50%, their consultation fees might be a bit higher, and there might be that wiggle room to move up into, you know, the 50, 52, 55, whatever percentage sort of way rather quickly, depending on how well you're going. So it's important to take that into consideration.
Yeah. Should we maybe have a little chat about what we think the pros are of being a subcontractor?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And realistically, I think as time went by for me, there were moments where I certainly wanted to be an employee. I was a subcontractor for 8 years, I think, before I became a director of a clinic. And so just those initial things like holidays, for example, you know, you'd go away for a week or two and you obviously wouldn't get any money coming in, but...
And you're spending money.
Exactly right. And you're spending money. So, you know, I always felt the holiday might have been costing me double. But then also other things around, you know, some habits that I, you know, admit didn't get into, which I probably should have, you know, putting super away, being as strict as I could with putting money away for tax and those sorts of things. And they were some valuable lessons that I had to learn pretty early in the piece. When you get that first big tax bill, it's a bit of a kick in the pants. And so you just, you know, those were some of the negatives.
For sure. I mean, look, just touching on those things, I mean, in terms of that pay when you're away on holidays, I find that in that subcontractor type model, it really is important to look at your monthly and then your quarterly and then your yearly income, because for different reasons, you might have a week where you're quieter or you're away or there's a public holiday. That weekly amount starts to look pretty grim. And it's important that you take a bigger picture look and say, okay, well, how is this arrangement working for me over a 3, 6, 12 month period, to give you a much better idea of what it looks like.
Yeah, and I think realistically, your quarterly BAS statements are a great indication of that as well. You know, they can be a bit of a drainer, but they do give you a fair guide of how you're tracking each quarter. And so, you know, you might look at a quarter and say, well, I only worked nine weeks that quarter, but, you know, the previous quarter I worked 12 and all of a sudden I've earned a similar number. So, you know, your weekly earnings have obviously increased because of that whilst you're at work. But that being said, it is something that you or, you know, you need to, you pay someone to help you with. Like, it's not as super easy. Once you get used to doing it, it's not too hard. But the first one was a bit of a minefield for me. And, you know, I'm still trying to get my head around some of the things in taxation because it's constantly changing.
Yeah, when you do your BAS, Matt, or when you were, did you pay the tax PAYG or did you do annually? Can you remember?
No, I did PAYG. Yeah, definitely. So I hated getting that really big tax bill at the end of a financial year. And so I always liked to chip away. Some of the strategies I sort of had were around setting up some different bank accounts, and so having basically a bank account that got I put all my money in and then paying my tax to a different bank account, my super into my super account, obviously. And so that was a good habit to get into. The one issue with that was you've got to be pretty self-controlled, and especially if you know the car rego comes up, or you know your national registration or your association fees come out, and you've got a big, you know, hundreds of dollar bill come up, you know, and that tax account sitting there with a few thousand dollars in it, you know, that can look pretty well, pretty good to use. Yeah, exactly right. And so, you know, and I've fallen into that trap, and I certainly, you know, a couple of years after starting working, we got married, and so, you know, there were some big bills coming out at that time, and I probably wasn't as strict as keeping my tax in the tax account as I probably should have. And you can fall into some traps of that. So you've got to be, I guess the underlying thing there is you have to be disciplined with what you're doing.
You really do. And I mean, if you do end up in trouble, I mean, we all have unexpected financial things happen to us over time, or even expected things that just cost more than you think they should. as long as you're on top of it, with those basses in particular, you can have a look at where you are. It's a really good snapshot, but you can also pay your tax off by installments.
Yes.
I've done that once where it was just like, oh geez, I'd rather keep that money myself and pay it off in little bits and pieces, for a bit of security, having that cash with me, not all of a sudden all with the tax man.
Mm.
But you know, there are strategies there, and the ATO is actually pretty good at helping you out if you go to them.
Yes.
For help.
Yes.
If they're coming to you with expectations, you end up in a bit of a trickier situation.
Yeah. And look, generally what I've found, as long as you are paying money to the tax office in that installment, you can actually dictate how much you can suggest, what you can afford. And so as long as you're consistent and you're paying that, they're happy. They're generally happy, and you're exactly right. As long as they're not having to chase you, you're in a good situation. And I guess the other side of that is your super as well. And you know, you might come out and be treating somewhere between 10 and 15 patients in your first week. You've earned $600. It's pretty difficult to go, well, I've got to put 30% of that aside for tax and super.
Yeah.
Because you know, like, you might have rent or whatever it is to pay, and it's, you know, it's not a lot of money. And so I guess to go back to your initial point about the pros and cons, the pros of a subcontractor model is that the potential there is to earn a lot higher.
Yeah.
The con is the potential is there to earn a lot lower.
Yeah. And I mean, there's going to be people listening to this and they're going to say, oh no, I pay as an employer, I pay a fantastic amount that's above what the average person earns as a subcontractor. And that may very well be true, but to some extent, your earnings as a subcontractor are somewhat unlimited. The more you work, the better it is. It can be really beneficial for a clinic, especially a smaller type clinic, to want to use that model. And the reason why I would see that, and this is what I did initially, was it's a lower risk.
Mm.
And that can, you know, be protective for the person who's got a small clinic, who wants to slowly increase the size of their patient load.
Mm.
And the important thing is that it's, in my opinion anyway, is that you're having an open and frank conversation with the person who you're putting on. And if you're the potential graduate or new staff member, what does that look like? What's it look like going forward? What are my potentials for increases? Do I reach a maximum level of percentage? Let's say you're seeing quite a few patients and you've paid over, say, $600 to the clinic that week. Does that max out? Do you get paid do you only pay a percentage up until X amount of dollars and then the rest is all yours? It can be a really mutually beneficial structure for a small clinic that allows less risk.
Mm.
But it has to be on, you know, both of your terms. Yes. Not just on the clinics and not just on the person.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that new grads definitely struggle with initially, is they do have a little bit of negotiation power at that in-few table, and it's something to just be aware and ask those questions. I think a lot of people will be really excited that they've got a job or been offered a job, but they may not actually know what they're going to be paid or how that's going to work, because they just simply haven't asked the question.
And we might get some kickback here, Matty, but I would say you've probably got less negotiation available in the Melbourne CBD and the Sydney sort of CBD and inner suburbs than you would, say, moving to WA or moving to Northern New South Wales or Queensland. There's just, you know, it's a supply and demand model, and there's a lot of people who want to be in the Melbourne inner suburbs. So as a healthcare practitioner, you're up against a lot more competition.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go rural or interstate, there's less demand. Basically, I reckon you can draw a line. If you're a physio, an osteo, or a paro, the further you go away from where there's a teaching hub,
yeah,
the more negotiation power you've got.
Absolutely, absolutely. And look, realistically, all you got to look at is social media now and the jobs advertising pages to see where those jobs are constantly being advertised, you know, rural Australia, etc. And, you know, a lot of those are doing an employee model because that's what they feel they need to do to get staff and to keep them. And you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a positive thing. So
what about some cons then of the subcontractor model, Matty?
I think over my experience, there's been a couple of cons, and some of the things you probably don't even think about. One of the things initially a few years ago was when I was trying to purchase my house, you know, the bank saw it as a much higher risk being a subcontractor self-employed than someone who's an actual employed a person. And so, you know, luckily my wife was employed, so it worked okay.
Same situation as us.
Yeah, and it is really fascinating just having those conversations. And I can sort of see the bank's point there. There's obviously a little more protection if you are an employee. And, you know, those sort of come in. The other things are so obvious. You know, if you're sick, you don't get paid. You know, if you hurt yourself, you don't get paid. If you don't turn up to work, you don't get paid. And so it's that simple. It really is. You know, your earning potential on paper can be a lot higher, but there is obviously some risk to that.
The safety blanket as an employee of being able to say, I know I'm going to earn X this week, and that might not all be treating patients too. It may give you the freedom, maybe not freedom, but if your utilization isn't to the 100% level, you might be spending time doing some business development work, and if that's part of your contract, and you might get to see the other side of how a clinic runs. Whereas if you're a subcontractor, in your spare time, well, you're not earning any money, so is there any expectation that you do any work? It is beneficial for you to do it, but you know, you can't be demanded to have
that. Exactly right. And I think as a business owner, there's some awareness around that. There's been a number of cases in Australia recently of various subcontractors trying to get their super paid to them from practice owners, even if they've had a subcontractor arrangement in.
I would say that's not isolated to health professionals either.
No, probably not. And you know, a lot of different contractors thing. And what we're seeing is that the subcontractors are winning the majority of the cases. You know, the tax office and whatever else are very sympathetic towards that subcontractor rather than the business owners. And you know, if you're a business owner, you've had someone subcontract for you for 11 years, that could financially ruin you as a business owner, you know. And so I think it's part of the reason why in my clinic I certainly looked at an employee model just as a protection for the business. But it's also, I think there is some benefits there definitely for new graduates coming out of university to be employed straight away. And we might as well move the conversation towards that now. But, just so you get an understanding, and you can readily access this online, there's the Health Practitioners Award in Australia, which gives you an indication of what you'll be paid depending on if you come out of university with a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, or a PhD, and then price points beyond that, moving on from that. And that's what we use to tailor our contracts. It's consistent, and we've speaking to other business owners, it's been pretty much what they've implemented. And that gives you a really good baseline for a full-time employee, permanent part-time, I should say, or a casual employee as well. And then loadings in regards to after hours, weekend work, etc., etc. And I believe the award's actually changing in July this year to broaden that scope as well in terms of hours. So just keep an eye on that, I guess. If you're listening to this now in 2019, by the time you graduate at the end of this year, the award would have changed. So it's if you are moving to an employee, I think you just need to get your head around those sorts of things. But as an employee, you have your contract, which has your leave entitlements, it has your maternity and maternity leave. super annual leave, sick leave, these sorts of things implemented into that. And so, you know, on paper it might seem, well, potentially you mightn't earn as much, but there is some security around that. And as I said earlier, the banks much prefer that much prefer that model if you're wanting to buy a house or an apartment or something in the next 3 or 4 years. But then also that the idea of putting some super away and investing in your future isn't necessarily a bad thing either.
Yeah, I think there is some statistics around if you are an employee for the first year or two as a health professional, you are on average going to earn more than someone on a subcontractor in the inner suburbs. There is some data around that, but it's definitely a horses for courses, I think. And I think it's worth highlighting that a lot of the time, the people who are using the models have experienced both themselves as people too. Like a lot of practice owners, directors, were subcontractors at some point. They may have been employees at some point too. So they will have a good understanding of what it's like for both. And most of the time, just having a good conversation with them around why they're doing, like, what, okay, well, Matt, why do you do an employee model? They'll tell you why they do it, and it gives you a nice way of being able to have an open discussion about, okay, well, I see the benefits of this, and I see the perceived benefits of it, and that's going to be a match that works for you or not.
Mm. Yeah. Yep, exactly right. And I think you want to just understand the scalability within your contract as an employee. The one thing that we certainly implement at our clinic is what we call a life cycle. So what we expect from a new graduate moving through first, second, third year practitioner, right to what we would consider an experienced practitioner, what that looks like from a pay point perspective, what that looks like from an expectation in regards to not how many patients you see, but what you do for the clinic in that regard. And we try and be as transparent as we can with that. So there's no surprises as you move through. And you know, you understand where we want you to be at 2 years of practice, where we want you to be at 5 years of practice, how we want to make you the best practitioner you can be, but also help you to reach certain goals. And you know, if a goal is to open up a clinic one day, well, how can we help you do that and reach that goal? And so that's something that we really push. And something that we've had, you know, some great success with straight away. And so it's certainly an interesting time within the health professions also, you know, and that subcontractor model, I'm not going to say it's on the way out, but there's definitely more language around it than for sure. There used to be.
I think I've heard a couple of people say until the GPs get rid of their subcontracting model that they'll probably stick around.
But yeah, and look, realistically, my wife's a GP, and some of you might know that, and others as wouldn't. And you know, that's certainly the conversation in the GP area. You know, they're acutely aware of it, those practice owners as well. And there's some heat on that topic right now, and so I think we can expect that they will move into that sphere pretty quickly as well. Yeah.
In terms of having employees coming on, Matt, what kind of things do you use to incentivize, just broadly? You don't have to be
too... Yeah, look, I won't go into particulars, but we have a bonus system related on patients treated. And so it's a percentage-based system, and we bonus quite high around that. So to simplify, it's basically having a carrot dangling there, yeah. You know, to get them to want to not just turn up and treat, you know, a few patients a day, but to actually strive to get as busy as possible. And you know, we pretty much, if you break down the nuts and bolts of it, you know, you can almost you will double your clinical income by hitting those numbers. And so, you know, there's a significant opportunity there to grow your income quite dramatically. And I think you'll find that's pretty standard across a lot of industries where, you know, you'll have your set salary, but there will be bonuses based on you hitting certain benchmarks.
And I think that I wanted to come to that actually, that those benchmarks, or some clinics will call them KPIs or whatnot. It's really important you have a good understanding of what those metrics are. And a couple of examples I'll look at is, and again, horses for courses, and people can do their own thing, but some clinics might use a return rate, like how many times does a patient see you on average, right? And are you able to flag patients? Like last week I had a patient who was only in Melbourne for a week. Okay, I'm never going to see that patient again. They don't live in Melbourne. It was a friend of someone that was a patient of mine. Can I flag that patient and take them out of that metric? Because otherwise, that can significantly then affect my ability to hit my bonus if that's one of my KPIs. So making sure that you have a good understanding about the possible implications of what your performance is based upon. The utilization rate that you were saying, Matt, I think is a fantastic way of being able to judge, you know, what's the net use of this practitioner to the clinic. It gives you a really good understanding of where their time is being spent. But I am personally more aware and potentially a little bit uncomfortable with some of the other KPIs that you hear floating around, because I think that they in some ways can be really set up to make getting those bonuses more difficult. The other thing I would ask is, you know, ask a clinic owner, how often are the practitioners meeting their bonus targets? Are they attainable? In a larger clinic, there's more people, therefore the patient spread is larger. So, you know, does that factor in? If somebody else comes into the practice and is an extra practitioner as to what's currently there, that's going to affect everybody's patient load. Will that then affect my bonus? It's important that you have an idea about that. Otherwise, you know, no one wants a disgruntled employee, right? No. So it's good for you and for the practice owner. And again, if a practice owner is uncomfortable with answering those questions, then maybe that's a sign that they haven't had a thought through that.
And you want to ask, is that where you want to be? And that's the thing. I think as a practice owner, you want your people striving to hit those numbers and to be competitive about it, you know. And I think that's business, really. And you know, we'll see that and up and down and those sorts of things. I think this is when we were trying to work out our employee model. We sat down and we looked at the data and we went through those sorts of things, and we looked at utilization rates and understanding that if someone's got, you know, one of the comments I remember making clearly was, you know, well, if they're available for 80 time slots, do you think they're physically capable of treating 80 patients a week? You know, and if they're not, then how's that affect their utilization, you know? And our expectation might be, well, you know, that magic number for that person might be 55 patients a week, although they're available for 80 time slots, and then working out utilization rates around that. And so it is something that is considered, and I think the point that you made earlier where we've all been in that situation is a really, really valid point. I think the one thing that we're trying to do, and obviously drawing from our experience, is trying to be as fair as possible to everyone. You know, there's obviously security benefits for the clinic, but then there's also assurities for the employee that they're going to have a set income, that they've got bonus targets that they can try and attain, and that's going to help grow their clinical income. But they're also going to be well supported throughout that whole process.
Yeah, and like, we'll make no bones about it. Like, a clinic is setting up a bonus system because it's good for them too, right?
Absolutely.
It's beneficial for both of you to reach those numbers. This is a question without notice, Matt, so hopefully you can answer that. What would you do if a practitioner gets pretty close to their bonus but doesn't meet it? Do you manage that, the fallout from that potentially? Like, what if it's, you know, what if they become, you know, really close? Like, what if they're 1% off or something? Have you thought about, and not necessarily saying that it's a financial reward, but have you thought about what the implications of that might be?
Yeah, well, look, absolutely, absolutely. And that's where the communication comes down to it. And we're really clear on the I don't like the term KPI, but
yeah.
We're really clear on the points where they have to reach. And so we work in a round up system, if that makes sense. We don't, so, you know, if it's a mark where, you know, you've got to hit 60% of your utilization, and there's things that, you know, a new patient time takes an hour, whereas a return patient takes half an hour. So we like to round up in that, and we count them as a whole. So, you know, a new patient is counted as two rather than the one time. And, you know, once they hit that landmark, if they're at 59.2%, instead of rounding down to 59, they'll be rounded up to the 60. Yeah. And we've been clear on that. And I think that's the fairest way, to be honest. You know, we bonus specific to each week in isolation. You know, you could have a dull week where, you know, you've just had a bit of a shocker, or, you know, it's just been a quiet week, but the other 3 weeks of the month have been really great. And so we've broken it down in that, because I think, once again, that's the fairest
way. Super fair. Yeah. And again, another sort of question around that, and different practices will do different things, but do you have a graded system? Like, do you have different points on that ladder, or is it just a one metric?
No, there are different points. Yeah, yeah. So there's a point where you get basically 80%. Of what your fee is, and then there's another point where you keep 100%.
And that's
we obviously want you striving to that 100% mark, because it's valuable for the clinic, but it's obviously, you know, if you're getting 100% of consultation fee, incredibly valuable for you as a practitioner.
I asked that question with an expectation of that answer, and the reason being that with the employee model, that's really still giving you a subcontractor benefit in those situations. And I think a really fair employee model includes those incentives.
Oh, absolutely. And you spoke about, you know, there being no risk for the business owner. It's a zero risk proposition for the business owner as well. You know, the clinic's made good money. The practitioner's been well paid, and now, you know, this hitting those bonus targets, what a brilliant opportunity to increase your clinical income. And
everyone's smiling then, I think.
Oh, exactly right. All right, I think that's a really good point to finish that podcast on there, Craig. Once again, folks, if you've got any questions, please feel free to email us at prackready@gmail.com. That's prackready@gmail.com. Be sure to spread the word to your fellow students.
Matt gets
colleagues.
Instagram all the time.
Yeah. Oh, and Instagram. Yeah, definitely, definitely. Look us up at PrackReady on Instagram. You can see our ugly mugs and whatever else, and the beautiful lycra that Craig turns up in
most weeks.
And you know, and if you do really appreciate what we're doing, feel free to hit that donate button at the bottom there and shout Craig and myself a coffee. We do much appreciate it. We're hoping to give you a lot more information over time. And if there's any topics that you want covered or you're not sure about, or any real specific questions, once again, you can email us at prackready@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram.
You're rambling again, Matt.
I am rambling. All the best. Thanks for that, Craig.
See you, buddy.
All right, bye-bye.